In early September of 1988, at 6:15 in the morning, on the first day of his senior year of high school, 17-year-old Marty Tankliff called Suffolk County, New York 911 dispatch. He had found his 62-year-old father, Seymour, on the floor in the den of the family's home, bludgeoned and bleeding profusely from a slash in his throat, just clinging to life. Marty discovered his 53-year-old mother, Arlene, lying dead in the master bedroom, also beaten and with her throat cut. The teenager did his best to keep his unconscious father alive while he waited for an ambulance. When a police officer arrived, Marty said he didn't know what happened. He'd gone to bed about 11 o'clock the night before while his parents were hosting friends for a poker game. Marty was the only other person who lived in the house. He was the couple's adopted son. Mr. Tankliff had just wrapped up a successful insurance career, having recently sold the business due to some health issues, and he invested the proceeds in several bagel stores and a fitness gym. Marty's father was also the village constable in the exclusive neighborhood where the family lived on a cliff overlooking New York's Long Island Sound. The crime scene investigation produced very little evidence. Police believed that Mr. Tankliff had been hit over the head while sitting at his desk and then been attacked with a blade of some type. And although they didn't find a weapon, they suspected that a kitchen knife had been used to cut both Seymour and Arlene Tankliff's throats. The lead detective, a man named Jim McCready, took Marty down to the police station to gather more information. After 4 hours of intense questioning, officers arrested Marty Tankliff for the murder of his mother and the critical injuries to his father. How'd they come to this conclusion? Well, Marty had admitted it. Or at least that's what Detective McCready said after interrogating the teenager. But the resulting confession was in the detective's handwriting, not Marty's. Marty steadfastly denied admitting to the crime, and he never signed any type of confession paperwork. In fact, Marty said that when police first questioned him that morning, he told them who he thought was responsible, a man named Jerry Stuerman, who was a disgruntled business associate of his father's in the bagel stores the two men owned together. A Stuerman owed Seymour Tankliff $500,000. Marty told police that Stuerman had been at the poker game at the Tankliffs the night before and was the last guest in the house. The teenager was adamant that if Stuerman had left their home while his father was still capable, his dad would have locked up the house, set the home alarm, and turned off all the lights before going to bed, as was his usual custom. When Marty found his parents that morning, the alarm was not set, the doors were not locked, and the lights were still on. So what led to the teenager's admission of guilt? According to Marty, Detective McCready told him during the interrogation that Mr. Tankliff had briefly regained consciousness at the hospital and stated that his own son, Marty, was the person who attacked him. The detective also told Marty that some of his hair was discovered in his mother's dead hand and that tests had shown Marty's shower was used that morning to wash off blood from the incident. McCready explained to Marty that people sometimes block out horrible incidents from their mind, especially when they're distraught or in shock. Ultimately, Marty began questioning his own sanity, wondering if somehow in his sleep or in some altered state of mind, he could actually have been the one who attacked his parents. Was he going crazy? Had he done this? Marty could hardly bear the thought of it. Only after that did Detective McCready read 17-year-old Marty Tankliff his Miranda rights. Next, McCready wrote out the confession based on his assumptions. But even though Marty was confused, he absolutely refused to sign that statement of guilt. The teenager even asked to be given a polygraph lie detector test to try to get at the truth, but police refused. Unfortunately, Seymour Tankliff died from his injuries about a month later. In fact, he never once regained consciousness and was never able to tell his son that McCready had completely fabricated the story about a phone call from the hospital that implicated Marty. Surprisingly, Detective McCready has never denied using those misleading tactics and out-and-out lies during the young man's questioning. Within a week after the attack on the Tankliff couple, their bagel store partner, Jerry Stuerman, took $15,000 out of a joint bank account the business associates shared. In a plan to skip town and stage his own death, Sturman named his girlfriend the beneficiary of his life insurance policy and left New York for California. He assumed a fake identity, got a new hairstyle, and shaved his beard. But despite all that, Suffolk County police never went after Sturman in any serious way. Perhaps this had something to do with alleged connections between Sturman and Suffolk County police, including stories of police payoffs for cocaine deals conducted out of the bagel store by Sturman's son in the late 1970s and early 80s. Detective McCready did locate Sturman and did bring him back to New York, but McCready refused to connect him with the deaths of Seymour and Arlene Tankleff. After all, why would he once he had gotten their son to confess to the crimes? Now, at trial in 1990, McCready indicated he first became suspicious of Marty because he appeared somewhat devoid of emotions at the crime scene. Police and some others saw Marty as a spoiled rich kid who resented his parents' rules and restrictions. People who were present at Marty's trial also said he showed little emotion. But Marty said he was taught by his dad to put emotions aside in any tense situation, because if you don't, you can't effectively deal with the problem you're facing. Besides, Marty still maintained his innocence. Since the original questioning, he had passed two polygraph tests, although those aren't admissible in court. And Marty believed the jury would realize the truth. After all, the prosecution had no evidence other than the confession he refused to sign that was written in Detective McCready's handwriting. There was simply no forensic evidence linking Marty to this crime. No blood or skin under his fingernails, no cuts or scratches to his body on the morning of the crime. Forensic testing found no blood evidence on either the weightlifting barbell or the kitchen knife, which the fabricated confession alleged were the weapons used. Besides, Marty knew his mother had been so fearful of her husband's business partner, Jerry Sturman, that she had actually written down the specific threats he had made to Mr. Tankleff and put that piece of paper in the family's home safe. Now, Marty felt sure that all these facts would prove to the jury he was not responsible for the death of his mother and father. So the young man did show little emotion in the courtroom. That is, until he was found guilty of murdering both his parents, at which point he completely broke down. While still a teenager, Marty Tankleff was sentenced to 50 years to life in prison. Some had suspected that Marty probably killed his parents out of greed, hoping for a huge inheritance. But Marty knew his parents' will was written to exclude him from inheriting anything until he turned 25. So he couldn't understand why people thought he could have done such a terrible thing for financial gain. Now, after Marty's conviction, his half-sister and her husband, who, by the way, happened to be Marty's only relatives who did not stand up for him, they inherited Marty's portion of his parents' $3 million. And you won't believe what they did with the money. They opened a restaurant and bar near the courthouse with a new business partner, none other than Detective McCready. You just can't make these kind of stories up. Now, during this same time, the State Investigation Commission for New York issued a report about rampant corruption they had discovered within Suffolk County Police. It was discovered that Detective McCready had perjured himself in an earlier murder trial. McCready was also later charged with assault for his part in a barroom brawl. In both his perjury and assault charges, McCready's attorney was Thomas Spoda, whose law partner, by the way, had been the district attorney who prosecuted Marty's case. Oh, and Spoda's firm had also represented Jerry Sturman's son when he finally did get charged with dealing cocaine out of the bagel store back in the 80s. And we'll come back to Spoda in a moment. While in prison, Marty kept insisting he was innocent. He contacted organizations whose missions are to help exonerate those who are falsely accused. By 2001, a decorated, retired New York homicide detective, Jay Salpeter, agreed to work for free to aid Marty's cause. A saltpeter found new witnesses and clues that all pointed to Mr. Tankliff's business partner, Jerry Sturman, as having masterminded the murders and gotten some of his goons to carry them out. Saltpeter even located a man who admitted to having driven the getaway car that night. This man described a pipe used in the attack having been thrown out of the car as the killers were fleeing the scene. Saltpeter discovered a pipe fitting that description in the spot where the driver said it would be. The getaway man passed a polygraph test and later signed a legal affidavit as to what he had seen the night he drove two men to the Tankliff residence. The driver said he thought they were going for a burglary, only to see the guys get back into his vehicle with blood on their clothes. Now, this guy also had previously confessed to his getaway role in that crime to both a Catholic priest and a nun, who were also willing to testify so long as they had the confessor's permission. Saltpeter had even located eyewitnesses who could testify to seeing Sturman and Detective McCready together on several occasions before the murders, despite McCready's claims that he never met Sturman before the Tankliff couple was killed. They also found out that McCready was not the next officer in line on the police duty roster on the morning of Marty Tankliff's 911 call. He didn't even live close to the Tankliff residence. Yet he's the one that showed up to take the investigation 19 minutes after the call went out. All this newfound evidence and dozens of witnesses who were willing to testify as to what they'd seen or heard Jerry Sturman or his thugs do and say was ultimately presented at Suffolk County evidentiary hearings. Presiding at those hearings was District Attorney Thomas Spoda, the same guy who had represented Detective McCready in two legal issues and whose law firm had served as legal counsel for Sturman's son's cocaine charges. Needless to say, at the 2006 hearing, Marty Tankliff's attorneys did not win their motion for a new trial. The appeals that happened went all the way up to the New York Supreme Court. Finally, in December of 2007, after 6,338 days behind bars, that's 17 long years, 36-year-old Marty Tankliff's 1990 conviction was unanimously overturned, and he was awarded a new trial in Suffolk County. Although he was released from jail, the case wasn't completely over. There was still the possibility of a retrial. However, based on the allegations about the corruption in Suffolk County, Attorney General Andrew Cuomo, who would later become governor of the state of New York, he announced in June of 2008 that the state would not retry Marty Tankliff for the murder of his parents due to insufficient evidence. Now, that's just one case where a false confession was presented. False because the accused never even wrote the alleged admission of guilt, yet it got him convicted and sentenced to 50 years in prison. It may seem like a near impossibility, but Marty Tankliff's story is just one of way too many, especially in cases involving juvenile suspects or people who are mentally incapacitated in some way. Corrupt or simply overzealous law enforcement officers, misleading interrogation methods, and false technology have been used to dupe naive people for far too often and too long. In 1998, 12-year-old Stephanie Crow was stabbed to death in her Escondido, California bedroom with no signs of forced entry into the house. After 11 hours of coercive interrogation, police literally convinced her 14-year-old brother Michael that he had killed his younger sister, though he had not. Investigators used a piece of bogus technology called a computer voice stress analyzer to trick Michael by saying the machine showed he was lying. Now, that instrument, which was developed specifically for interrogation purposes, has not a shred of scientific evidence to back it up. In fact, there is no such thing as a lie detection machine. Even if the machine could measure stress, that's in no way the same thing as measuring truth. Who wouldn't be stressed in an interrogation situation especially when being questioned about a murder. The voice stress analyzer is simply used to intimidate or dupe people into confessions. Still, police told Michael Crow that objective computer science was on their side. In addition, the officers lied to the boy, saying they had found his younger sister's blood in his room. The whole interrogation was video recorded, and by the time they broke Michael down, he was sobbing and saying, quote, "I don't even know what I did. I can't even believe myself anymore. I've been told I did this awful thing, but I don't remember it," end quote. Keep in mind, this is a 14-year-old boy faced with two adult police officers playing the stereotypic good cop, bad cop. At one point when Michael was left alone for a few minutes in the interrogation room, he just sat with his head in his hands and cried like a baby. It breaks your heart to listen to the interview. Just imagine how they scrambled that young kid's mind. In fact, coerced confession expert Richard Leo says the interrogation of Michael Crow amounted to nothing more than, quote, psychological torture. And where were Michael's parents all this time? Police had told them their son had been taken into grief counseling since he had just lost his little sister. And that's not all. After questioning two of Michael's friends, police got one of them to confess too and amassed enough faulty information to arrest the other one too. Luckily, the truth eventually came out before the three boys faced a murder trial. A 28-year-old mentally ill homeless man had been seen wandering the Crow's neighborhood on the day of Stephanie's murder. Several people reported the guy's strange behavior, even stating they saw him in the Crow's driveway looking up at the house with outstretched arms. On the morning after the murder, police did pick the guy up for questioning, and they actually found blood on his clothes, which they kept for DNA testing. But despite that, on the very same day, two officers coerced a confession out of 14-year-old Michael Crow. That is something I just cannot understand. The eventual results of DNA testing on the blood from the homeless man's clothing, it showed the blood was from Stephanie Crow. But get this, the Escondido Police and Prosecutor's Office didn't pursue the case against the homeless man because they didn't want to face the public scrutiny for their error in settling on Michael as guilty. The California Department of Justice had to take over the case and prosecute it, which they did in 2004. Over 5 years after the truth about Stephanie's death had finally come out. In 2011, the Crow family was awarded over $7 million in damages. Surprisingly, using methods like lying to a suspect during interrogation and talking about evidence that doesn't even exist is completely legal, just so long as the officers don't use it to either promise leniency or a worse punishment. Although that happens too, of course, in some of these cases, like when a suspect is told that a confession is the only way to avoid the death penalty. And it's not uncommon for officers to look for ways to keep parents out of the room when interrogating juveniles, which I'm sure makes those of us who are parents just shudder. I'll never forget an experience I had while in the car of a public defender. He was giving me a ride from a hotel to a Tennessee courtroom for a second opinion case in which I was to serve as an expert witness. Now, we passed a traffic stop along the side of the road where a couple of teenage girls were standing behind the open trunk of their car while two uniformed officers were digging through the contents of the trunk. And the attorney said out loud, quote, "The answer is no." And I said to him, "What do you mean?" And he said something like, "I tell everybody I know, especially kids, that if a police officer asks if he can search your car or your purse or something like that, the answer should always be a polite no, not until my parents or attorney are present. Those kids have no idea who could have put something in their trunk that might implicate them for something they had nothing to do with, especially if it's a used car or a rental. He said there's no way they should allow a spontaneous search like that." Still, I wondered how many of us would have the nerve to say no to the police, especially those of us who've done nothing wrong and who respect people in authority. Now, someone who had never been in trouble in his life and was raised to trust and respect authority was Christopher Ochoa, a hardworking 22-year-old man who had been an honor student in his high school and editor of the school's literary magazine. Ochoa was brought in for questioning in the brutal 1988 killing of a 20-year-old woman at a local pizza restaurant in Austin, Texas. The manager, who was alone at the time, had been taken into the back, tied up with her bra, raped, and then shot in the head. Ochoa and his friend-slash-roommate, Richard Danziger, worked at another franchise of the same pizza chain in Austin. And when the pair visited the pizza store where the murder had taken place, they talked to the security guard posted there about what had happened. That's when police began to suspect maybe they had something to do with the crime. The things police did to intimidate Ochoa during 24 hours of interrogation over the course of 2 days are shocking. Ochoa was screamed at, he had furniture thrown at him, police threatened him with the death penalty, they even tapped the veins in his arms to show him where the lethal injection would be placed. They told him how his fellow prisoners would repeatedly rape him while he awaited his death. What evidence did they have? None. But they lied to Ochoa, and they told him that his best friend, Danziger, had turned him in. And they told Danziger pretty much the same thing, but in reverse, putting both men in the same position and pitting the two friends against each other. Danziger also denied having anything to do with the crime. I'm sure each of those guys was shocked at the thought the other might have done it, but was trying to implicate him. Important, too, was that Ochoa claims he had asked for an attorney early on, but that request was denied. Although much of the interrogation was audio recorded, there were repeated stops and starts in the recording, as well as 3 hours of missing tape. Ultimately, Ochoa signed a confession. He said he did so because the police just wouldn't let up. He decided to plead guilty after police began calling his mother and telling her the horrible things that would happen to him in prison. The police worked on Mrs. Ochoa to convince her son to plead guilty or he was going to die. Ochoa's mother was ill, and in fact, she suffered a stroke that her son believes was from all the pressure surrounding the whole situation. Now, he says he knows people find it inconceivable that someone would sign a confession about something they absolutely did not do. But he said when you're the suspect, it's different. Ochoa wanted his mother to be spared the torment. He just wanted the whole thing to end. In 1989, Ochoa got life in prison for the crime. So did Richard Danziger. But 8 years later, a different Texas prisoner wrote to numerous authorities claiming that he had been the one that killed the young woman. Most of those letters were ignored. But eventually, Austin investigators went back to Ochoa to question him further. And believe it or not, he still said he committed the crime. That's because he thought recanting his confession at that point would stall his chances of parole. By 1999, though, after 10 years in prison, Ochoa decided to contact the University of Wisconsin's Innocence Project. DNA evidence from the victim was luckily still in storage and proved that the semen from the case belonged to neither Ochoa nor Danziger. He was exonerated in 2001 after nearly 12 years in prison, and Chris Ochoa was chosen by ABC News as their Person of the Week in May of 2006. That was also the day he graduated from the same University of Wisconsin Law School that took on his exoneration case. Unfortunately, while in prison, his friend Richard Danziger received a vicious beating from a fellow inmate and wound up with permanent brain damage. He had already been transferred to a secured mental facility. Although Danziger is now a free man, he still requires full-time care. The reasons for false confessions vary, ranging from intimidation or actual violence against the suspect, as we've seen, to interrogations that happen while the person being questioned is under the influence of drugs or alcohol. There are also problems when authorities interrogate persons of diminished mental capacity, which most police officers are never trained to do. That's what happened to Eddie Joe Lloyd, who was convicted of the 1984 rape and killing of a 16-year-old girl in Detroit, Michigan. While Lloyd was being held in the Detroit Psychiatric Institute, He wrote to police that he had supernatural abilities that would let him help them solve local crimes. Now, police questioned Lloyd at the mental health facility without an attorney present. Lloyd ultimately confessed to killing the young girl, but his confession now clearly shows police fed him details about the crime. There's no way he could have known. In addition to police injustices, Lloyd's case also suffered from legal malpractice. In 1985, Lloyd's first court-appointed attorney, who did little to investigate into the case, withdrew himself about a week before the trial, leaving Lloyd's second attorney just 1 week to prepare the case. The trial wasn't postponed. This second attorney was no better, though. He called not a single witness in defense of his client, not even someone to attest to Lloyd's mental health history, nor did his attorney cross-examine critical witnesses like the interrogating officer. After his attorney's 5-minute closing argument and less than 1 hour of jury deliberation, Eddie Joe Lloyd was convicted of felony murder. In open court, the judge actually regretted Michigan not having the death penalty, saying it was a shame that all he could do was put Lloyd in prison for the rest of his life. Lloyd's court-appointed appeals attorney never once came to meet him in prison. When Lloyd wrote to the judge to complain about the bad lawyering he had received, the appeals attorney responded by telling the judge his client was, quote, guilty and should die. After the Innocence Project in New York took on the case, DNA evidence exonerated Mr. Lloyd, and he was set free after 17 years in prison. Unfortunately, he died only 2 years later at 54 years old. Lloyd's estate was awarded $4 million from Wayne County, Michigan. The personal tragedies and decades lost by these kinds of miscarriages of justice are incomprehensible, not to mention how costly these situations are to all of society. Innocent people are locked up at taxpayers' expense. The real perpetrators are left to strike again, and huge sums of money are paid out in damages to those who are exonerated, and rightfully so, in my opinion. But that money can never make up for the years lost or the stigma and memories these exonerees will carry the rest of their lives. Fortunately, a number of organizations have begun to tackle these cases using today's forensic science technology and challenges to police and legal procedures. Now, the Innocence Project is just one of such groups. It was founded in 1992 at the Cardozo School of Law at Yeshiva University in New York. According to their website, over 300 convicted individuals in the U.S. have now been exonerated, and that's by DNA testing alone. The average prison time served was 13 years, and 18 of those people were on death row. Innocence Project studies document either confessions of guilt or guilty pleas in about 25% of the cases in which DNA evidence proved the convicted person did not commit the crime. Many of those involve what the project calls confession contamination, where details that were never released to the public were present in the alleged confession. So the only way the interrogated person could possibly have known those specific facts is if they were fed to them by law enforcement during the interview. Some people who sign a confession just do so to get out of the interrogation. They do that with the belief that good science and law will sort things out later, never dreaming it might be decades later. But even when suspects are not fed details of the crime by police and get all or most of the details wrong in a false confession, all the discrepancies are often thrown out in court as attempts on the part of the suspect to minimize their deeds. The single thing that is often clung to in the courtroom is that the person said they did it, even if they didn't get the details of the crime right in their confession. Now, I would never want to end this lecture with you thinking I don't have the utmost respect for law enforcement or our legal system. I do believe that the vast majority of those incarcerated are guilty of their crimes, and that nearly all police officers and court-appointed officials do extremely good work. But like any other profession, there's malpractice that irrevocably damages the system and those caught up in it. A study by the Chicago Tribune examined 400 overturned homicide cases throughout the United States and noted that not a single prosecutor got reprimanded, no attorneys lost their jobs, and no one representing the law went to prison. We certainly can't say that for those who were in the defendant's seat in those cases, and my heart goes out to those who are innocent but found guilty.